LRS and Will Acheson do not provide any legal advice. Listeners to this podcast and visitors to the LRS website should consult with their own lawyer for legal advice. LRS is not a law firm, and our employees are not acting as your attorney. The information contained in this podcast and on LRS.com is general legal information and should not be construed as legal advice to be applied to any specific factual situation.
Hello, folks. I'd like to welcome you to LRIS's First Thursday podcast. My name is Will Acheson, and I want to take you through developments in public safety, labor relations, things that have occurred over the last 30 days or so. And I want to start with something that happened yesterday, at least yesterday at the time I'm recording this. We don't have a formal written opinion from the judge in this case, though, but it is a whopper. What the judge said during the course of oral arguments that were had yesterday. What's the case? It's the city of Stockton, California's attempt to come out of the bankruptcy process. Stockton has a huge debt and is one of several California cities that have sought bankruptcy protection. What was going on before the judge yesterday was whether the initial plan submitted by the city of Stockton to escape from bankruptcy, whether that plan should be approved. And the judge actually didn't make a final ruling on that. But what he discussed were objections raised by one creditor, somebody the city owes money to. This is the Franklin Templeton Investment Fund, a mutual fund company. Franklin Templeton had bought $36 million in Stockton's bonds, and the city's proposal in bankruptcy was to pay Franklin somewhere around 1 cent on the dollar for that debt. The city was also proposing that it not cut any of its obligations to California's PERS system, its pension system, and that it not cut any pension benefits to try to reduce its liability to PERS. And that's the discussion that was held before Judge Christopher Klein in California yesterday. And Klein made it absolutely clear what he thought about the city's arguments that PERS system contained benefits that were protected under the constitutions, both the Constitution of the U.S. and the California Constitution, and a series of retirement statutes in PERS. The judge didn't accept that argument. The judge said, California public employee retirement law, and I'm quoting, is simply invalid in the face of the Supremacy Clause of the United States Constitution. And he ruled, I've concluded, that the pension could be adjusted. Now, he didn't make any final ruling on whether or not there should be an adjustment in pension payments or what that all means in terms of another clause in the U.S. Constitution, the clause that I've referred to earlier, known as the Contracts Clause. Instead, he said he wanted to go study the issue more. But there is no doubt that this is a victory for the Wall Street firms that typically own the bonds, own the debt that is issued by governments around the country that don't want to see pension benefits elevated anywhere in the bankruptcy process above that debt. Now, Stockton had some interesting arguments that it made in the court hearing yesterday and in papers that it filed with the court. Stockton is worried about a mass exodus of public employees if, in fact, pensions are reduced. It has a reason to be worried about that. Over the time period that the bankruptcy proceedings have been pending, the average tenure, the average length of service of police officers in Stockton has dropped from 14 to 9 years. If, in fact, pension benefits are seriously cut, the city is predicting what it refers to as a mass exodus of city employees. The judge, in essence, said, doesn't really matter. Pension debt, he said, pension contracts. That's just one type of debt or one type of contract as far as bankruptcy court is concerned. It's not to be treated any differently than the bonds that the city's issued. And if, in fact, those pension obligations need to be modified, the judge ruled he thinks he has the authority to do it. Now, this follows on the heels, about a year ago, of a very similar ruling from a bankruptcy judge overseeing the city of Detroit's bankruptcy. Since then, the whole Detroit issue with respect to pensions has been settled. The rebound in the stock market caused the city's unfunded liability to go way down, and so the pension plan was much better funded, and retirees and active employees in the cities were able to, they were all able to reach a settlement in Detroit. It doesn't look like there's a settlement coming anytime soon in Stockton. I will say we're early in this process. What we have are two rulings from trial court judges, no rulings from appeals court judges, and of course no ruling from the Supreme Court. Pension litigation is incredibly political when you look at the judges who decide these cases. If you look at the party affiliation of the president who appointed the judge, you can pretty much predict with a lot of accuracy whether or not that judge will think that pensions have any heightened protection in the process. If the judge has been appointed by a Republican president, the judge is likely to rule the way that we saw Judge Klein rule yesterday in Stockton. Judge Klein, for example, and the judge in Detroit were appointed by Republican presidents. If the judge is appointed by a Democratic president, you could expect to see a little bit more charitable treatment towards pensions. So we have trial court rulings in a highly politicized area of the law. We don't have anything really coming from an appeals court system yet, but I will say this, if you're concerned about the sanctity of pensions, you better be following the Stockton case, because it looks like this one has a long way to go through the court system. Next up, I want to stay in California and talk for a little bit about peace officer dishonesty cases, disciplinary cases. As you all know, law enforcement recruits are often told that the one disciplinary offense that won't be tolerated by law enforcement agencies is untruthfulness, is dishonesty. I've heard the phrase, you lie, you die, so many times I've forgotten how many times I've heard it. It's common parlance still in many police academies. Now, even though law enforcement officers are told that, when you read disciplinary decisions from courts, from civil service commissions, and from arbitrators, you see, and you increasingly see, what I think of as gradations of untruthfulness, a recognition that there are lies and there are lies. To be sure, untruthfulness in official police reports or in testimony, particularly where the untruthfulness impacts the rights of a citizen, to be sure, that's not tolerated by anybody, and that's an automatic termination offense with very, very few exceptions. However, other forms of untruthfulness, it might be, for example, a police officer being untruthful about why he or she wanted to use sick leave or how a particular piece of equipment was damaged, that may well bring a punishment lesser than termination. And as I've mentioned, we're seeing this as sort of an ongoing trend in police disciplinary cases. Now, there's several reasons for that. I think one is just simply a matter of evolution, the way the decision makers look at the issue of untruthfulness. I think another is it's a bit of a pushback against what we've come to know in law enforcement circles as the Brady Rule. And this rule comes from a case called Brady versus Maryland, a 50-year-old Supreme Court case. This is the rule that's now being interpreted as requiring public safety agencies to disclose to a local prosecutor when a peace officer has been found guilty of untruthfulness or some form of dishonesty charge. The result is that you many times have seen officers placed on what's called a Brady list, meaning the district attorney either completely will not prosecute any cases in which the officer has been involved, or perhaps will be disclosing to a judge in an in-camera hearing the officer's disciplinary records. We have seen police departments respond to these Brady lists by, in some cases, keeping an officer on, but assigning the officer to duties that won't require testimony. In other cases, simply ignoring the fact that the officer is on the Brady list, and many times firing the officer for not being able to do the essential functions of the job, which include testimony in court. So many times, this Brady situation has resulted in very, very serious job consequences for officers. They lose their jobs. As the Brady rule has become more ingrained into the law enforcement culture, you're starting to see pushbacks against these Brady lists. You see it sometimes with statutes. In October of 2013, the California governor signed a bill. It was known as Senate Bill 313. That amended California's Peace Officers Bill of Rights to say simple placement on a Brady list cannot be a basis for discharging or otherwise disciplining a public safety officer. You can still discipline for the underlying dishonesty. That's okay. But what you can't do under this new statute is to discipline for placement on a Brady list absent proof of the underlying dishonesty. 2014, the Maryland legislature adopted very similar legislation, and it's being considered in other states right now. So what we see are some legislatures pushing back against the Brady list. We've also seen courts do it. There's this amazing case last year out of the North Carolina Court of Appeals involving a trooper who lied about how he lost his hat. And the North Carolina Court of Appeals actually reinstated him after he had been discharged. And the court ended up saying, basically, look, there are gradations of untruthfulness. There's, you know, lying on a search warrant affidavit. And then on the other end, there's lying about your hat. And lying about your hat just isn't the same thing as lying on an affidavit. And we've also seen this sort of pushback in arbitration. There are a series of arbitration decisions, and we'll post for you citations to them along with this podcast. There are a series of arbitration decisions where arbitrators have said much the same thing. Simple placement on a Brady list in and of itself isn't enough to justify a termination for untruthfulness unless the employer can also prove that the employee engaged in the underlying dishonesty. So you've seen this pushback, but there's a decision from the California Court of Appeals that came down in the last three weeks, that makes it very, very clear that wherever this pushback has been, it hasn't gotten to the level of the California appellate court system. And the court makes it absolutely clear, if you lie as a police officer in California, the courts are going to uphold your termination without regard to what the lie is about, without regard to mitigating circumstances. What's the case? The case involves San Diego County and a deputy sheriff by the name of Aaron Aguilera. What did Aguilera lie about? He was a cover officer on a motor vehicle stop, and he ended up talking with his supervisor about when the vehicle that was involved in the stop, when it was hooked up to a tow truck. Aguilera told his supervisor it was already hooked up by the time the owner of the vehicle, who was the driver's father, showed up on the scene. In fact, that was incorrect. The owner arrived before the vehicle was hooked up to the tow truck. Aguilera was fired for that. He appealed his discharge through the County Civil Service Commission, And the commission ended up, there were some interim court appeals and the like. After all of that was done, the commission ended up with a very curious sort of decision. The commission said, look, the way the county conducted the investigation violated California's Peace Officers Bill of Rights, and the result was that a couple of Aguilera statements had to be suppressed. And the commission said, look, in the absence of those statements, Aguilera has to be reinstated, even though he was dishonest. The Court of Appeals eventually overturns the commission's decision. And the court uses language that could hardly be stronger. The court says, look, because law enforcement officers, and I'm quoting, are held to the highest standards of public trust, even a single act of dishonesty by a peace officer warrants termination. The court goes on to say things about the Brady Rule. It doesn't use those terms, actually, but that's really what it's talking about. The court goes on to talk about the Brady Rule using this language. The court says, look, the entire administrative record and decision will be available in any future motion to disclose Aguilera's disciplinary record. Aguilera can no longer effectively serve as a sheriff's deputy. A future records request will yield his disciplinary record, including the termination order and commission's decisions. A deputy with this history of untruthfulness, evasiveness, or obfuscation is permanently compromised as a witness in any future judicial proceedings, because any opposing party will readily be able to impeach the witness with the prior dishonest statement. And so the court upholds Aguilera's termination. It's that last part that I want to talk about, the part about the Brady Rule, because really, I think the court got that fundamentally wrong. It's not as simple as the way the Brady Rule is operating right now. It's not as simple as if an officer is terminated or is disciplined for dishonesty that the officer can't testify. And that's what the California court is suggesting. Rather, let me suggest that there's really several stages of analysis when you're looking at a termination for untruthfulness or any discipline for untruthfulness. This isn't my idea. This, by the way, is laid out in loving detail in that North Carolina Court of Appeals case I talked about just a minute ago. The several stages of analysis are this. First of all, what's the nature of the officer's untruthfulness? Does it impact, for example, the rights of a citizen? Or is it more about something that is routine? Secondly, will the prosecutor think that this disciplinary record necessarily has to be submitted to a court for an in-camera hearing? Or will the prosecutor conclude that there's no disclosure obligation? Third, even if it's submitted to an in-camera hearing, is there a likelihood that the judge will order it disclosed to a criminal defendant? Fourth, if the judge orders the disclosure, will the criminal defendant actually use the information? Maybe, maybe not. Depends upon the nature of the case and the nature of the untruthfulness, nature of the discipline, what the finding looks like. Depends upon a lot of things. And fifth, if the criminal defense decides they want to use the statement, will it be effective in impeaching the officer? Now, simply a discipline for untruthfulness isn't automatically relevant in a criminal proceeding. A court's going to look at a lot of things in determining whether or not such a disciplinary record will be admitted into evidence. And even if it's relevant, it may well not impact the jury's eventual determination of guilt or innocence of the criminal defendant. So I think when the California Court of Appeals says in Aguilera's case, look, simply because there's a finding of untruthfulness means that Aguilera can never testify again, I think that's actually a pretty thoughtless decision. It doesn't go through this multi-step analysis that other courts have. But nonetheless, there is no denying the court's very, very strong words about untruthfulness and law enforcement officers. And there is no question that at least at the Court of Appeals level in California, courts are going to uphold any employer discipline for untruthfulness, even if it's termination, even, it seems, if it is for untruthfulness that is really unrelated to any substantial impact on a citizen's rights. I want to talk a little bit now about an Americans with Disabilities Act case that came out of the Ninth Circuit Federal Court of Appeals. It involves a police officer by the name of Matthew Weaving, who worked in Oregon. He worked for the Hillsboro Police Department. And the court's decision, I think, is pretty interesting in the way it looks at whether a particular mental condition, in this case ADHD, whether it amounts to a disability. Let's reset this just for a little bit. For a condition, for some sort of mental or emotional impairment, to be considered a disability under the ADA, the employee has to show several things. It has to show, first of all, the existence of the impairment, whatever that might be. Secondly, the employee has to show that the impairment substantially limits a major life activity. And the ADA defines what major life activities are. And third, the employee has to show that with reasonable accommodation of their disability, they could do the essential functions of the job. Matthew Weaving, the police officer, who has had ADHD since he was a child. He disclosed it during his application process with the Hillsboro Police Department and indicated that he thought that his ADHD didn't affect him anymore. The department hired him and later promoted him to sergeant, even knowing that he had ADHD. And in the course of his career as a sergeant, Weaving had a kind of a curious record of interacting with others. He did well with the public. A lieutenant once observed that all of his interactions with the public were professional and that he displayed appropriate empathy towards members of the public. He did well with supervisors. His lieutenant or a different lieutenant wrote that Weaving had no problems communicating with him, the lieutenant, or with other supervisors. The problem was that Weaving did not do well with those he supervised. He had a communication style that apparently, according to the court's opinion, came off as arrogant and inspired fear. And it got worse and worse over time. By 2009, Weaving was placed on administrative leave with pay. His doctor sent in another diagnosis that Weaving had ADHD. The city conducts an independent medical evaluation, and two doctors found that Weaving was fit for duty despite his ADHD diagnosis. Nonetheless, the city eventually fires Weaving. Weaving sues the city under the ADA, claiming that he was fired for having ADHD, which is a mental condition that's potentially covered by the ADA. It goes to a jury, and the jury finds that the city violated the law and awarded Weaving a lot of money, awarded him $75,000 in damages, $230,000 in back pay, $330,000 in what's called front pay, and $139,000 in attorney's fees. That's pretty close to $750,000. The judge ends up not allowing or not granting Weaving's request for reinstatement because of what the judge referred to as hostility and antagonism between Weaving and members of the department. But nonetheless, the city balks at paying the $750,000 and appealed to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And the court overturns the jury's verdict. And the court focuses on whether or not Weaving's ADHD substantially limited Weaving in a major life activity. And Weaving's major argument was that he was substantially limited in the major life activity of working, Basically, he's saying, hey, I got fired for my ADHD. That sure looks like a substantial limitation in the major life activity of working. And the court didn't accept that argument. The court said, look, there's just not any evidence that Weaving was limited in his ability to work compared to most people in the general population. Quoting from the court's opinion, the court says, hey, there's evidence showing that Weaving was in many respects a skilled police officer. He had developed compensatory mechanisms that helped him overcome ADHD's impediments, and he succeeded in his career. He got promoted, and a psychologist appointed by the city deemed him fit for duty. This is not somebody, the court said, who's substantially limited in the major life activity of working. Weaving had a different argument. He said he was substantially limited in his ability to interact with others under the ADA. And the court said, well, no, not really. You may well be limited in your inability to get along with your subordinates. However, you were able to engage in normal social interactions, and you had little, if any, difficulty handling yourself with supervisors. And here's the tag quote from the court's opinion that I want you to hear. The court says, a cantankerous person who has trouble getting along with coworkers is not disabled under the ADA. One who is able to communicate with others, those communications may at times be offensive, inappropriate, ineffective, or unsuccessful, isn't substantially limited in his ability to interact with others within the meaning of the ADA. To hold otherwise would be to expose to potential ADA liability employers who take adverse employment actions against ill-tempered employees who create a hostile workplace environment for their colleagues. What about this decision? It by the way, is not a unanimous decision. It was a 2-1 decision of the court, written by a judge who very, very rarely rules in favor of employees over the course of his career. What about this decision? Is this going to hold up? I know there's a petition for what's called en banc rehearing before the Ninth Circuit, which would mean a much larger set of judges would rule on the issue. It's kind of an interesting decision because, in fact, if you accept that jury's verdict, Weaving was fired because of the symptoms of his ADHD. And there's no evidence the city tried to reasonably accommodate that, or at least accommodate it in the context of Weaving's job as a police sergeant. That sure looks a lot like a employee who is being fired because of their mental impairment, because of their ADHD. And that certainly looks like a substantial limitation in the major life activity of working, at least as the ADA has been expanded over the last few years. I'm not sure this case is going to hold up. It may well be that the Ninth Circuit doesn't review the case. They take very few of these cases on an en banc level. But it is sort of a curious ruling. I mean, I get what the city is trying to do here. It's extraordinarily difficult to have a supervisor who, no matter what you do as an employer, can't get along with subordinates. And maybe there was nothing the city could do to reasonably accommodate Weaving's disability. It's just still a bit of a troubling case. While I'm talking about disability-type cases, I want to talk about a workers' comp issue that comes up from time to time. This case comes out of Nebraska, out of the Douglas County Sheriff's Department, and it involves a deputy by the name of David Brock. And the question is, does the off-duty surveillance of a public safety employee who is off on workers' compensation leave, does that surveillance violate the employee's privacy rights? Well, here's what goes on with Brock. Brock sustained injuries to his neck and shoulder while struggling with a suspect while on duty. The county accepts his claim for workers' compensation, but pretty quickly starts thinking that Brock may be malingering. So the county hires private investigators to put Brock under surveillance and report on what it is Brock is doing. It's not just Brock. The county hires private investigators from time to time to look at other employees, but one of them was Brock. This goes on for a couple of years, and eventually Brock is released by his doctor to return to light duty 4 hours a day at the sheriff's office. And while he's on light duty, while that release is pending, Brock is again placed under surveillance. And all told, between 2007 and 2009, Brock was under surveillance for about 100 hours. Now, during this last part of the surveillance, after he's been released for light duty, working only 4 hours a day, an investigator videotapes Brock. And what's Brock doing? He's operating his pickup truck with a snowplow attached to it, and he's doing it for 5 hours. He was clearing snow from parking lots, business parking lots. He's working for his father's lawn maintenance and snow removal business. Some weeks later, when Brock's doctor saw the snowplow video, he asked Brock about what, you know, how can you be doing this and have the symptoms that you are reporting to me? And Brock is saying, no way could I drive a truck or operate a snowplow. Brock lies to his doctor. And the county eventually terminates Brock for being untruthful in his interactions with physicians, in his interactions with workers' compensation specialists, and also in his interactions with the department. Brock doesn't challenge his termination. Instead, what he does is sues the county, saying that the surveillance violated his property rights, his privacy rights. And privacy rights that would be guaranteed under the Due Process Clause of the U.S. Constitution. The Nebraska Supreme Court rejects Brock's claims. The court says challenges to surveillance in workers' comp cases, these challenges, they're not uncommon, but when you make a claim for workers' compensation, you have to expect, employee, that there's going to be reasonable inquiry and investigation of the claim. And to that extent, your privacy is going to be limited to some measure. Here the court says privacy wasn't unique to Brock. It was done by the county 5 to 10 times a year with different cases. It served a valid purpose. It wasn't intrusive. It didn't go on Brock's property or anything. Brock was in a public place where he could be seen. And the county had a legitimate interest in trying to make sure that nobody was defrauding it or the workers' compensation system. The court ends up saying, Brock, look, you exposed yourself to public observation when you plowed snow in a business parking lot. The county did not violate your privacy rights by videotaping you. This decision isn't anything new. As I mentioned, this sort of claim comes up from time to time and comes up with a great deal of regularity, in fact. I have never seen a court hold that videotaping of a public safety officer in a public place for purposes of determining whether or not workers' compensation fraud is present, I've never seen a court hold that that violates any rights that employees have. I think the Nebraska Supreme Court here got it right. When employees put in workers' compensation claims, they are going to have a somewhat diminished right to privacy. Next case I'd like to talk about involves Fire Chief Frank Trout of the village of Westmont, Illinois. Trout was the chief for a number of years, eventually was fired, and was fired for misconduct, and he responded with, among other things, a lawsuit asking for overtime under the FLSA for his activities. And here's what Chief Trout was saying in his lawsuit. He was saying, look, I understand that the FLSA has exemptions for certain classes of employees, executive employees, professional employees, and administrative employees. I understand that. But the Department of Labor has some very specific rules that govern public safety employees and deals with whether or not they are exempt. And basically, what those rules say is if the public safety employee, without regard to rank, engages in line-level duties, they're not exempt under the FLSA. So, for example, if a police officer, without regard to rank, so a sergeant or a lieutenant or a captain or whatever it might be, engages in law enforcement duties, goes out there and arrests people, provides cover on search warrant executions, makes traffic stops, whatever it might be, if that employee engages in those duties, they're not exempt under the FLSA, under these rules, without regard to what their rank is. And in the fire service, same thing. If the firefighter engages in fire suppression duties under the Department of Labor's regulations, they're not exempt. We don't quite know yet. The law hasn't really been well developed enough to tell us what the key ratio is. In terms of time, if there is one, what percent of the time do you spend on line-level activities versus what percent of the time do you spend on management activities? We don't know what that ratio might be. We don't even know, really, if it's a ratio that is expressed in terms of time. It may be importance. How important is it, the various aspects of the job? All of that is being fleshed out in litigation around the country. So what's going on in Trout's case is he's pointing to these regulations, and he's saying, look, I'll admit that most of the time I did management-level duties. I did things like I created department policies. I hired and fired employees. I did interviews for hiring and promotion and things like that. And he also says, look, I admit that I made a lot of money as fire chief. He was paid a salary of $125,000 a year. But he's saying, there's a particular reason why I think I'm not exempt. And it's because of my status as a duty officer. And what does that mean in the village's fire department? It's a system where one officer is assigned to be on call for a shift at all times. The duty officer, who is expected to remain within a 3-mile radius of the village during the shift in order to respond to emergencies or alarms or whatever it might be, that duty officer can be the fire chief. It can be deputy chiefs, it can be captains, and on some occasions it can be other people. The department has something called an administrative director, has a fire prevention bureau director. All of those people can be duty officers. Trout, as fire chief, did serve some time as a duty officer. And he is saying, my work as a duty officer destroys the exemption, the village's claim that I am exempt under the Fair Labor Standards Act. And a federal court considering Trout's claim says, no, it didn't. Court says it's very clear, based on facts that you admit, Chief Trout, it's very clear that your primary duty was that of management of the fire department. You only rarely served as a duty officer outside of your shift hours. Even when you were a duty officer, remember, you're on standby, you remained in charge of the fire department. And your work as a duty officer, and I'm quoting now from what the court had to say, constituted only a fraction of total working hours. In fact, the court criticizes Trout by saying, look, the only evidence that you've given us is that over a many-year period of time, presumably since 2006, you worked up to 1,900 hours as a duty officer. You haven't given us any documentation of that. You haven't told us how much of that time was spent simply on standby status as opposed to actually reporting to a fire or something like that. But even if we accept that that 1,900 hours was all spent actually engaged in fire suppression duties, the rest of the time, while you were fire chief, you were working 12,000 hours. And the court ends up saying, duty officer assignments don't transform your position into something other than management. It would be interesting if there was a little bit more in the record in this case. What if, for example, Trout was able to show that 20% of the time he was actually engaged in suppression duties, or 30%, or 40%, or 50%. Where's the dividing line for that? We don't yet know under the FLSA. You can tell what's going on in this court's judgment. The court is looking at Chief Trout and is saying, come on, you're the fire chief in a small village. You really think you're not exempt under the FLSA? You're the boss. You're exempt. The law in this area really will continue to develop as we see more and more of these cases come in. And hopefully the records in those cases are going to be a little bit better developed than they were in the Trout case. Last case I want to talk about is another Illinois case. And this is one dealing with something that comes up also with a fair amount of regularity. Are injuries suffered while participating in physical fitness tests, are they compensable injuries, and at what level are they compensable injuries? This is a case involving a police officer by the name of Michael Schaefer, who worked for the village of Lake in the Hills, Illinois. And under the collective bargaining agreement between the village and the union's called the Metropolitan Alliance of Police, under the contract, officers get additional comp time off based on their performance on a test involving sit-ups, sit-and-reach, bench press, and a mile-and-a-half run. It's the bench press that poses the problems in this case. Under the contract, each of these tests is pass-fail, and you pass if you get to the 40th percentile on your first attempt to pass the test. You're not obligated to do any more if you get to the 40th percentile, and particularly on the bench press, you're not obligated to attempt to bench press any more than the minimum weight to get the comp time. However, if you do try to bench press more and get to a higher percentile, you can get additional compensatory time off. Schaefer is going through this test. He lifts the minimum weight, all is well and good. He is then asked by the tester whether or not he wants to increase the weight to the 80th percentile level. Schaefer decides he wants to give it a shot, and when he lifts the bar off the bench, his shoulder gives out. And it turns out he has a right rotator cuff tear. There's an attempt to repair the injury surgically, and it was unsuccessful. And then the question comes, what claim does Schaefer have to the equivalent, Illinois equivalent of workers' compensation benefits, or not Illinois, but under the village's pension system? And really the question that the court eventually focuses on is Schaefer engaged in what is known as an act of duty? Because under Illinois law, you only get line of duty disabilities if an officer or firefighter is engaged in an act of duty. In terms of police, that term, act of duty, is defined as any act of police duty inherently involving special risk not ordinarily assumed by a citizen in the ordinary walks of life, a risk that is imposed on a police officer by the statutes of the state or the rules of the particular department. The court says bench pressing is not an act of duty. Schaefer argued, look, it has to be because here I'm bench pressing. Ordinary citizens aren't required to take mandatory physical tests. And the court says, well, not really. Schaefer, you were under no duty to attempt the particular physical tests that led to your injury. And you passed the minimum weight. What you were doing was you were trying to earn more comp time. And your election to attempt to lift a heavier weight was for your personal benefit, and it was not an act of duty. Now, the law in this area really varies a lot from state to state. For example, there's a rich body of California law that off-duty officers and firefighters who are working out in order to attempt to later pass a mandatory physical fitness test, that those officers and firefighters who are injured in those off-duty workouts actually are entitled to workers' compensation benefits. Other courts, I can think of some cases from Florida, rule to the contrary. And I think what's going on really in the Schaefer case is the court is very much concerned about the fact that Schaefer had no obligation whatsoever to try to lift the extra weight. I think if this test had been a mandatory one, where Schaefer was required to lift the extra weight in order to get to the 80th percentile in order to hold on to his job, I think you see a different result. I think then you see this being an act of duty. But Schaefer, in the court's judgment, was just trying to get extra comp time, and that is not a special risk. He was not engaged in a special risk that is faced by police officers and firefighters. I want to close by talking a little bit about bargaining trends, if I might. I talk about this from time to time, probably about every quarter I talk about it. And I want to say that really the situation is unchanged from what we've seen in the past. It's looking like wage settlements for firefighters and police unions in this country. It looks like they're going to average this year somewhere in the 2 to 2.5% range. We are not seeing nearly the cuts in health insurance. We're seeing very few cuts in health insurance. And we're seeing relatively few attacks on pension systems. They're still out there. But it looks like the big attempts to get cuts in health insurance and pensions may be behind us. Now, simply by saying, look, the average settlement out there is 2 to 2.5%, and we're not seeing much in the way of attacks on health insurance and pensions, I don't mean to say that's the case everywhere. This varies a lot from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. There are some agencies where you are seeing wage awards or wage settlements of 4 to 5% a year, and even more. There are other places where you are still seeing wage freezes and you are still seeing substantial reductions in health insurance benefits. I'm just saying, on the average, when we look at public safety agencies around the country, we appear to have turned the corner on the recession and that we look like we're back into an era where wage increases are roughly the same as the consumer price index. Let's hope we stay there, right? Because the last few years have been extraordinarily difficult in terms of the labor relations environment. Nobody's happy. Nobody on management side or labor side has been happy when they go to the bargaining table. And let's hope that this era of stability that we seem to be entering is one that will continue for a long period of time. That's it for this month. Thanks for listening. This is Will Aitchison, and I hope to see you for November's First Thursday podcast.